With the end of the first cycle of the corporate sin of the people of the nation of Israel, about 150 years had passed since the departing from Egypt with Moses. And we have calculated this number in this way. Moses led the people for 40 years, so we've got 40. Joshua led the people for 50 years, so we've got 50, so now we've got 90. 90 years had passed. Then after the death of Joshua, the first cycle of sin began of the worship of Canaanite gods and of graven images on the Canaanite high places that should have been torn down. Now once the false gods, the worship of the false gods was in full swing, the Lord allowed Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram to control Israel for 8 years. So at the end of the 8 years, the Lord raised Othniel to defeat Cushan and regain control of Israel and tamp down the Canaanite worship among the people in the Promised Land. Othniel controlled the nation as a prominent judge for 40 years. Thus, 90 years for Moses and Joshua, plus 8 years for Cushan, and 40 years for Othniel equals 138 years. Our only question is how long were the people of Israel worshiping the Canaanite gods before the Lord allowed Cushan to capture the nation? We do not know. However, knowing that all the elders and leaders who served with Joshua and who had seen the mighty works of the Lord had to die before the people began the first cycle of sin, it is probably safe for us to say that between 10 and 12 years had to pass by. Therefore, it seems also to be safe to say that about 150 years, were included in that first cycle of the sin of the nation Israel. But once Othniel died at the end of the 40-year cycle as its nation's magistrate, a new crop of leaders was coming into control. Think of it this way. In 40 years under Othniel, babies were born and matured into solid leaders by the age of 40 with opinions, with ideas, and with desires. And with the death of Othniel, they would allow the nation to drift away from the Lord, just as the leaders after Joshua did at least 50 years before. So thus, with the death of Othniel and the new leadership in place, cycle 2, which we will call the Moabite takeover, began. The nation of Israel is in full-blown evil with the worship of Canaanite gods, and the Lord is tired of it again. He allowed the foreign king to take over the Promised Land. So we enters into the scene here a character by the name of Eglon, Moab's king, and he reigns over them or rules over them for 18 years. Chapter 3, verse 2. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord, and he gathered to himself the sons of Ammon and Amalek. And he went and defeated Israel, and they possessed the city of palm trees. The sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. So how long did the Lord allow the people of the Promised Land to sin against him before he did something? We do not know. What we do know is this. The Lord allowed a cousin king of the Israelites to take control of them. His name was Eglon. He was the king of Moab. And we must remember that Moab was the son of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. Therefore, Moab was a distant cousin of the Israelites. When the Israelites came through the Moab territory under the leadership of Moses, Moab was not harmed by the Israelites because of this relationship. Now, but that was about 100 years before, and much had happened in that 100 years between the cousins. Eglon did not capture the Promised Land by himself. He enlisted the help of the Ammonites, the Ammonite people. Now, Ammon was the second son of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. Therefore, the Ammonite people were close relatives of the Moabites. And because the Ammonites and the Moabites were basically cousins from two brothers who were also cousins of the Israelites, when Moses led Israel up that east side of the Jordan River and camped across from Jericho in Moab's land, he defeated the Amorites, not Ammonites, but Amorites. He did not harm these Ammonites or take their land because, like the Moabites, they too were distant cousins. Now, with the help of the Ammonites, Eglon also enlisted the help of the Amalekites. As much as we have spoken about the Amalekites in Israel's story, indeed, we remember who they are. But just to be sure, let us take a moment just to do a little review. It was the Amalekites who followed the Israelites right into the Mount Sinai area as they were arriving there for the first time. And there at Rephidim, the place of the split rock where the water came out, they attacked Israel. Moses sent Joshua with an army to defeat them. And as long as Moses held up his arms, Israel prevailed. But when Moses dropped his arms, the Amalekites prevailed. Finally, the Amalekites retreated in fear and frustration. And it was also the Amalekites, by the way, whom Israel had to face in battle shortly after those 12 spies came back to Kadesh Barnea from searching out the Promised Land with all the milk and the honey and the grapes and all of that. Now, we can go on from this to discuss the Amalekites, but that's enough of a reminder. They're a thorn in the flesh. I mean, a thorn in the flesh of Israel. So we will also see them in the future when they continue to be the enemies of Israel. The Amalekites lived in the area of Hebron, by the way, and up the country, on up through the country, they lived in the tribal area of Ephraim. So they're there, and they are not out of the land. Now, under the Lord's command, if the Amalekites had been Canaanites, they should have been killed. Now, if they were not Canaanites, remember the Lord's command was that they were to be converted to worship the Lord Jehovah God, or they were made to leave the country. Or if they decided to stay, they were to be killed if they would not leave and not convert. We do not know the origin of the Amalekites for sure, but they were not direct relatives of Israel. So they came down through the Canaan line somehow, but we do not know how. Now, or I should say not Canaan line, but through Ham's line. Ham, the son of Noah, had a son by the name of Canaan, but he also had other sons and probably came through those lines. Eglon, with the help of the Ammonites and the help of the Amalekites, defeated the armies of Israel and set his palace of power in the city of palm trees, as the text tells us. Now, we've already discovered in our lesson so far that the city of palms, we discovered it in the book of Judges, the city of palms was Jericho. And Jericho had laid in ruins for almost 100 years. The city had not been rebuilt. Therefore, he had to have established a village near the ruins of Jericho, because those ruins of Jericho are not going to be rebuilt until later on. Now, from the new village near Jericho, Eglon ruled over Israel for 18 years. Later in this lesson, we will be given information that will almost assuredly identify the village of Eglon being established on that old campground of the nation of Israel, for which they called it in the Hebrew Gilgal, and it was just a plot of land on the east side of the wall of Jericho. So at the end of the 18 years under Eglon's control, the Lord finally raised a judge. Enter the judge, Ehud. He's Israel's judge for 80 years, verse 15a. But when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. In the first cycle of Israel's sin, it took only 8 years for the people to cry out to the Lord for help. What happened in this second cycle? Why did it take 18 years? Well, we're not told. But the critical point I want to make in this passage is the same point I made in that first cycle of sin. The Lord will not take and make an action while sin is in action until the sinner gets sick of the sin and calls upon the name of the Lord for help. He is always ready to help, but he will wait patiently until his creation is ready to be helped. But when the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord stepped right in to help. What did he do? He did the same thing he did in the very first cycle. The Lord raised up a deliverer for them. So in this case, the man's name was Ehud, the son of Gera of the tribe of Benjamin, a left-handed man. Now, we do not want to miss the importance of the background found in this part of the verse. First, Ehud was the son of Gera. Now, several hundred years later, during the life of King David, Shimei will also be identified as a Benjamite, the son of Gera. Now, in Chronicles 8:3, we learn that Jacob's son Benjamin had a son named Bela, who had a son named Gera. So Gera was evidently a common name among the men of the tribe of Benjamin. Now this Gera was the father of Ehud. Second, Ehud was of the tribe of Benjamin. In the first cycle of sin, I want you to remember, the Lord raised up a judge from way down south in the Promised Land to defeat the opposer or the oppressor way up in the far northern portion of the Promised Land. But in this second cycle of sin, the Lord chose a man closer to the oppressor. The destroyer's city was over in Jericho, the city of palms, the palm trees, and he chose a man who lived in the tribal area of Benjamin. By the way, the city of palms, Jericho, is in the tribal area of Benjamin. So the Lord selected a home tribal area judge to remedy this problem. Third, Ehud was left-handed. This entry is the first time we have heard about a left-handed Benjamite, but it will not be the last. When we arrive at Judges chapter 20, we will learn that there were 700 Benjamites, warriors, who could sling a stone with their left hand. Later in this lesson, we will understand why Ehud's left-handedness will be a great asset in defeating Eglon. Now, as we move into the last part of verse 15, we see that Ehud delivers a tribute to Eglon, verse 15b. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. Now, no doubt the nation of Israel had been sending a tribute to Eglon every year for 18 years. It was the practice in that day that a defeated nation had to pay tribute to the winning nation's king. A tribute is nothing more than a tax. The tax could be money, it could also be produce, or it could be livestock. More than likely, the tribute was due at least once a year in addition to the produce and the livestock tributes. In other words, a money tribute was due in addition to the produce and the livestock tributes. And in this case, the Lord had raised Ehud to be the judge. And it was time to send the tribute to Eglon, and the tribute was placed under Ehud's care to be delivered. But before departing his home with the tribute, Ehud plans to kill Eglon. The scripture speaks of the dagger hidden in verse number 16. Ehud made himself a sword which had two edges, a cubit in length, and bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. Now, we cannot imagine how long it took Ehud to make this dagger, or if he even made it himself. The text calls it a sword, but was only a cubic long. That's 18 inches long. It's not long enough to be called a sword, but the perfect length for a dagger is about 18 inches. Now, this dagger did not have to be made out of metal. It could have been made or carved out of wood, and it would have done just as good a job as we will see as we move on down into what was done with this dagger. So we do not know the composition of this dagger, but we do know that he made this dagger. Nevertheless, the purpose Ehud had for it, it had to have a sharp point, and as the text says, it had two sharp edges like a double-edged knife. Now, once finished, he hid the dagger under his cloak on his right side. Now, being a left-handed man, the dagger could be drawn from the right side naturally to be used. Right-handed men always carried theirs on the left side of their thigh to pull out. But remember, this dagger was hid underneath his garment on the right side. Most men were right-handed, and a sword or a dagger on the left side of a man would seem very natural to look at. And for a left-handed man to have a hidden dagger on his right side, little worry would be presented for a man who is coming to present a tribute to the king without the security guards around that king having concerns. Ehud would look like he was an unarmed man because the dagger was hidden. Now, prepared, we see the tribute delivered to Ehud in verse 17a. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Next, we see the king described in 17b. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. Now, you can picture a fat man in your mind's eye all you wish, but in this case of Eglon, you need to think of an obese man with rolls and rolls of fat, especially over his belly area, just rolls of fat. You will see why that is important in just a moment. So with the king described, we come to the assistants dismissed in verse 18. Now it came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. Now if Ehud carried any of the tribute to Eglon in his own hands, it was not all the tribute because Ehud had to have helpers helping him to carry this tremendous tribute to Eglon in the palace setting near that old city of Jericho. So once the tribute was presented, Ehud sent his men away. Next, the writer tells us of the secret announced in verse 19. But he himself turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep silent. We do not want to read anything into this verse that is not there. But it seems that this verse is telling us the location of the village of Eglon, located on the old campgrounds of the nation of Israel, for which Israel called that name in Hebrew Gilgal. It was just an empty plot of land there in the Arabah Valley of the Jordan River. It was Israel's first campground after crossing over the Jordan River, and it was right next to the wall of Jericho on the east side of the city of Jericho. There, Ehud dismissed his helpers when he saw these Canaanite idols, and there in Eglon's village at Gilgal, where he saw these idols, he turned. Now you might want to think of it this way. More than likely what has happened here in this story, Ehud and his men left the immediate presence of Eglon after the tribute was delivered, and a short distance from the king, more than likely still in the eyesight of Eglon, Ehud dismissed his men near a standing Canaanite idol. Let us not forget, the Moabites worshiped the Canaanite idols even back in the day of Moses and before. So once the men were dismissed, Ehud turned around and said something to Eglon, and he said this, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep silent. Eglon must have loved secrets. And because Ehud has just delivered this grand tribute, and because Ehud did not seem to have a weapon showing, that weapon that was on his left thigh, it was not showing, it would be normal for Eglon to be ready and willing to hear a secret from an unarmed man. Then we see the king is secluded in verse 19b. And all who attended him left him. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. Now, for whatever reason, Eglon's guards leave the king alone with Ehud. The king is by himself in a cool room on the roof. Now, more than likely, it had shutter-like windows and doors that could be opened so the king could feel the cool breezes that were common to come down the Jordan River Valley. But these cool rooms were also used as bathrooms. So as a reminder, Gilgal, where Eglon is stationed, is in that Arabah Valley where that Jordan River runs, and these breezes would have come down. So alone with Ehud is there, and we see that Ehud delivers this dagger. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrusted it into his belly. The handle also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the refuse came out. We do not know why Eglon trusted Ehud enough to allow him to come so close, but he did. And what did Ehud say to Eglon? He said, I have a message from God for you. Did Ehud have a true message from God for Eglon? Absolutely. The Lord God wanted Eglon dead. And when Eglon heard Ehud's words, notice that Eglon stood to his feet. And without knowing, Eglon put himself in greater danger than he would have been had he remained seated. Standing, Ehud had stretched out his chest area so that Ehud could drive that dagger down into his belly. If Eglon had remained seated, it would have been almost impossible to drive a dagger into the belly for an immediate deadly wound. But Ehud drove and buried this dagger into Eglon, and his fat engulfed the dagger. He was dead. All his muscles relaxed, because the scripture confirms this, because his bowels emptied as is normal at death. The refuge was released. Now, from the dagger delivered, it was time for the plan of escape. Verse number 23. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule and shut the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. So after killing Eglon, Ehud just simply walked out through the vestibule and shut and locked the doors behind him, and he left Eglon alone dead. After a while, the servants became concerned, and the writer presents the servants' thoughts in verse 24. When he had gone out, his servants came and looked, and behold, the doors of the roof chamber were locked. And they said, he is only relieving himself in the cool room. So Eglon's servants dismissed the locked doors, thinking that Eglon was simply using the bathroom in the cool room. What did the servants do? The servants paused before going in the unlocked doors. In verse 25a, it says, they waited until they became anxious. But behold, he did not open the doors of the roof chamber. But after a while, the servants became worried, and we now come to the servants' discovery in verse 25b. Therefore, they took the key and opened them, and behold, their master had fallen to the floor dead. Just because Eglon is dead, it does not mean that the Moabite rule over Israel is over. In the 18 years after Eglon was in the Promised Land, the Moabites had entrenched themselves in the land and would not leave easily. They were living in permanent structures, not in tents. Eglon's up on top of the roof. You don't get on top of the roof of a tent. So they're in permanent structures, not tents. And it would take a battle to run these people out. Ehud had to escape to a safe place. We find that in verse 26. Now Ehud escaped while they were delaying and passed by the idols and escaped to Syria. Well, evidently, during this second cycle of sin, the Israelites had allowed the building of idols throughout the land. And Ehud passed by these idols on his way to Syria. And Syria means woody. And it's a reference to a woody location on Mount Ephraim at the border of the land of Benjamin and Judah. Now, it was only a very short distance from Jericho and Gilgal. So at Syria, Ehud blew the trumpet in his home, in the home of the warriors of Israel. Verse 27, it came about when he had arrived that he blew the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was in front of them. Ehud was not disappointed. The army of Israel came to fight with him. Ehud led the army back to Jericho, Gilgal, and the camp of that dead king. So Ehud instructed the warriors here in verse 28a. He said to them, pursue them, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. This must have been a fast turnaround for Ehud and his warriors. The reason comes next. We now see the success of the warriors of Israel in verse 28a. So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan opposite Moab and did not allow anyone to cross. They struck down that time about 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel. Once it was discovered that Eglon was dead, the men of Moab and their families were probably gathering their things with the intention of heading back across the Jordan River to go back to the tribal area of Moab. The Israelites' warriors did not let that happen. Ahu and his warriors killed more than 10,000 mighty Moabite warriors and ousted the Moabites from the promised land that day. With the ousting of Moab, Ahu rules as judge over Israel for 80 years, verse 30b. And the land was undisturbed for 80 years. Surely Ahu was at least 20 years of age when he led that charge against Eglon and the Moabites. If he ruled 80 years, that means he had to have been over 100 years of age at his death. Nevertheless, Israel served the Lord under Ahu's lead for 80 years. But it is not clear if Israel began to fall into its third cycle of sin immediately after the death of Ehud. Why? Because the writer inserts another judge in the next text. Enter Shamgar, Israel's judge, for an unknown number of years. Verse 31. And after him came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. Our time is up. So we'll pick up with Shamgar the next time we come together, and I will tell you all about him in our next lesson.